talked about error correcting codes, and today what we're going to do is talk about one of the main applications of error correcting codes beyond just transmitting information reliably or storing information reliably, which is fault tolerance, or actually doing reliable computation even in the presence of errors. So I'll just say a few words about that very briefly. I mean, to really kind of understand fault tolerance deeply and you know, even to be able to prove things about the existence of a fault-tolerant threshold, which I'll say something about, requires quite a bit of work, and we don't have that much more time left, right? This is the last lecture. So I'll just spend 10 minutes or so giving you kind of a flavor of this. And then the main thing that I want to talk about in this lecture is quantum key distribution, which is a way of distributing a secret key between parties who have never met. And this is quite a useful thing to do for cryptography, and it's something you can do in quantum mechanics that you can't do classically. And you can think of it as a way that kind of, you can use quantum mechanics to get around the fact that, some quantum cryptosystems are broken by quantum computers, right? So if we could build quantum computers, we could break RSA. But quantum mechanics also gives us another way to communicate securely, and so that's quantum key distribution. And, incidentally, this is one of the most practical kind of quantum information processing applications. So, you can even buy commercial quantum key distribution systems. They're on the market now. So, so there are a lot of reasons to be interested in this. Okay. So first, let's just talk briefly about fault tolerance. So we saw how you could encode information in error correcting code so that it would be more resilient to errors. But now the question is, how can we do computation reliably? So we want to do reliable computation in the presence of noise. And actually, I mean, you could worry about whether this is possible in principle, and people even worried about whether this was possible in principle when they started thinking about classical computers, because of course, classical devices, sometimes, experience noise too. Now the classical computers that we build today are actually so reliable that we don't even need to worry about these issues of fault tolerance. But back in the day, people worried about these issues, and actually there was a whole theory of classical fault tolerance that was developed, initially by von Neumann, showing that actually you could do classical computation reliably in the presence of noise. In the case of quantum computers, this is an even more serious issue because it's very hard to isolate quantum systems from their environments. And we really think that that dealing with noise is going to be one of the hardest things about building a quantum computer. Doing logic gates well enough so that we can do many logic gates before we lose our quantum information to the environment. We need some kind of tools for dealing with it. So the main idea here is presumably clear, right? What we want to do is encode our information in quantum error correcting codes. So great. So now our information is protected from the environment, and we've seen how quantum error correcting codes protect quantum data from noise. But now what we want to do is compute on that data. So we need to perform logical operations. We need to do, say, the elements of some universal set of gates so that we could implement any quantum algorithm that we might want to do. And so we have to think about how to do that. And we definitely can't. So one thing you might try to do, but which we definitely shouldn't do, would be to decode the information and then perform the gates on the decoded information, with each qubit, each logical qubit really stored as one physical qubit, and then re-encode. I mean, a strategy like that is just not going to work, because then there'll be some time when the information is exposed to the environment. And so, you could have errors that happen then, and this definitely won't give you, something which is robust. So we need to somehow perform our logic operations on the encoded data. Okay, so we need to do encoded logical operations. And so you have to think about, what are the physical operations you would have to do on the physical qubits, if you have some single qubit encoded into the 9-qubit Shor code, what are the operations you would have to do on those 9 qubits in order to implement some logic gate, say some single qubit logic gate on those qubits. And so, you have to think about this. So for example, the simplest sort of thing you might think about would be, how would you do an encoded poly operation, right? So those are some single qubit gates you might want to do, say a poly X or a poly Z on the logical qubit. And so you could try to work out what the encoded poly operations are. So this would be just be an example, you know, the encoded poly operations. So for example, if we have the bit flip code, then, well, we could think about what the, you know, what the logical, say the logical X operation would be. And remember that in the bit flip code, we stored a, you know, this was the 3-bit repetition code. So we stored a 0 as 000 and a 1 as 111. So if we want to perform a logical X operation, we have to flip each of those bits. Right? And of course, this is going to be a high weight operator because, you know, the code will protect against any low weight bit flip, against a flip of just one bit. So we'll have to flip many bits in order to actually perform a logical operation. And you know, for this code, we're actually not protecting against phase flips. And you could see that, for example, one way to perform a logical Z operation would be to just perform a Z operation on the first qubit. I mean, this is sort of the reason that this thing is not good for protecting against phase errors, because you can actually implement a Z gate just by doing a Z on only one of the physical qubits. So you know, this is an example of the kinds of operations we would have to do in order to perform just a logical poly operation, a single qubit poly, or we could do, you know, polys on many qubits by doing this to multiple different encoded qubits. And you could work out what the logical poly operations are for any code that you like. I mean, you could maybe think about what the encoded poly operations look like, say, for the 9-qubit code. So you know, that's some set of encoded operations that you could think about how to do. But of course, this is far from enough. We have to figure out how to actually do a universal gate set. So let's think about, for example, how we would do a controlled NOT gate on 2 qubits encoded in the bit flip code. So this is just another example. So a controlled NOT on 2 qubits encoded with the bit flip code. Well, of course, the way that we implement a given logical gate on the encoded qubits is not necessarily unique. I mean, the information is stored redundantly anyway, so I guess it's not surprising that we could have multiple ways of doing the operation. I mean, you can already see that here, right? So we could just as well have done a bit flip on a qubit stored in this code, say by doing a Z operation on the second qubit or on the third qubit, right? Because the you know, any of those is going to put in a phase between the logical zero and the logical one state. So you know, there's not necessarily a unique way of doing this, but I don't know, maybe you can suggest some way of doing it. So if I have 2 qubits encoded using this code, say this is qubit 1 and this is qubit 2. So you know, we need 3 physical qubits to encode each logical qubit. So let me just maybe write that here. So this is qubit 1, and this is qubit 2, you know, logical qubit 1, and logical qubit 2. So how could I do a CNOT gate between these 2 encoded qubits? Anyone have an idea? So what I want to do is I want to flip the value of this qubit depending upon the value of this qubit, right? So the logical poly operation I want to apply down here is you know, logical X, right? So I want to apply a logical X down here only when this qubit is in the logical one state. And I'm only worrying, of course, about what happens to the, you know, to the code words. I'm not worrying about what happens when I don't have a code word. Right, that's right. So you can do a bunch of CNOTs. So you said between every 2 pairs. So I guess what you had in mind was like this. Is that what you had in mind? I'm guessing a little bit. It's not unique. So this will work, but this is definitely not the unique choice. So we could also do, say, for example, this. Right, this would also work, right? Because all 3 of these qubits, you know, if we have a code word, these 3 qubits are either all in the state 0 or all in the state 1, or in some superposition of them. But if we want to get this thing to work, it's enough just to think about basis states. So we only have to think about the case where these three qubits are either all 0 or all 1, because that's the case when we have a code word, right? So so we could do this because these, you know, three qubits have to be you know, the same. These three bits have to be the same if we're thinking about basis states. So you know, this is going to have exactly the same effect as this on the code words. Okay, but from the standpoint of fault tolerance, actually one of these is better. One of these is a better choice for how to implement the gate. Can you guess which? What do you think? The one on the left or the one on the right? Yeah, the one on the left is better, right? So this, we would say that this is a fault tolerant implementation, and that this is not a fault tolerant implementation. And you know, the reason is that errors can propagate badly with the one on the right. So you know, something that we would like is that if a single qubit error happens, it doesn't propagate to too many errors on the physical qubits, right? So you know, if it could be that we had we'll have the possibility for errors to propagate, right? Because we're you know, we're doing multi-qubit gates. We have to do multi-qubit gates in order to actually do anything. So that means that, you know, if qubits are being interacted, an error on one of them could turn into an error on you know, on both of them. But what we really don't want is that an error on one qubit could turn into an error on four qubits, right? So if we have, you know, if we have an error here, then that could result in an error on this qubit as well as these three qubits, and that could be bad. I mean, that's the kind of thing we can't correct against, right? Because if we have a you know, if we have a three qubit error occurring on the three qubit code, I mean, we really just can't say anything about what happens. But you know, if you know, in this case, if we have a one qubit error that occurs on any one of these six qubits, then effectively that's going to only turn into, it's only going to propagate into at most a two qubit error. In other words, we'll have at most, and in particular, we'll have at most, you know, one error in each of the blocks. So this is the kind of thing you have to think about when you're designing a fault tolerant implementation, that you you know, that you implement your gates so that errors don't propagate too badly. And you know, the nicest sort of situation that you can have is you know, this kind of situation where you can implement your gates just by acting independently on pairs of qubits with, you know, say the gate you want to implement is a CNOT gate. Here we just do a CNOT gate between every pair of qubits between the two blocks where we want to do a CNOT gate. So there's a name for, you know, being able to do a gate in this way. It's called implementing the gate transversally. So this we would call a transversal CNOT. And it's really nice when you can do gates transversally, because errors will always propagate in, you know, the least damaging kind of way. And so ideally you would like to be able to do you know, as many gates as you can transversally. Yes? So transversal means that if you want to do the gate, you know, some particular gate on encoded qubits, then the way that you do it is just to act with that gate independently on the different qubits, the different physical qubits that make up the logical qubit. So when we're talking about doing a CNOT between two encoded qubits, it means we just do a CNOT between qubits, you know, qubit one of logical qubit one and qubit one of logical qubit two, qubit 2 of logical qubit 1, qubit 2 of logical qubit 2, et cetera. Yeah, so that's called a transversal implementation, and that's going to be fault tolerant because the errors propagate well. So the best case scenario would be if, you know, maybe we could do an entire universal set of gates transversally. We could find a code where that was the case. So it turns out that that's not possible. It's simply not possible to do a universal set of gates transversally, and so you will need additional tricks in order to come up with some you know, implementation that's truly fault tolerant, regardless of what error correcting code you choose. But you know, some codes are better than others. So, for example, the Steen code, the 7-qubit code, lets us do quite a few gates transversally. So, let me not be more precise than this, but just say, you know, we can't do an entire we can't do an entire universal gate set, but we can do many of the gates that we want to do to have a universal set. We can do them transversally. And then we need some additional tricks in order to actually be able to do a universal set of gates. Okay, so this is the first thing that you want to do if you want to say something about fault tolerance, is you want to come up with an implementation of the logical operations where the errors don't propagate too badly. So where, you know, when you have some error that happens somewhere in the execution of the circuit, that it doesn't cause too many poly errors on the encoded qubits. Okay, so then what we would like to say ultimately is that if we use this fault tolerant implementation, that we can compute reliably really for as long as we want, right? So we would like to be able to do an arbitrarily long quantum computation where we can assume that effectively the error rate is, you know, for all intents and purposes, zero, right? We'd like to be able to make the error, the error rate arbitrarily small. So there's a strategy for doing this. So first, we're going to design fault-tolerant implementations of gates. So that, if we have an error model where an error happens with probability p, so errors with probability p, will translate into, you know, when those errors actually are happening. So this is the error rate on the, you know, the physical qubits. But then what we want is that the error rate on the logical qubits, so the probability that there's actually an error occurring on the logical qubits, will be higher order, will be, you know, at least order p squared, right? That was the kind of thing that we saw when we were talking just about error correcting codes. And now we would like that that's the case for our fault tolerant implementations of gates. So that this turns into a logical error rate, which is big O of p squared. And when you do this, you know, it's important that you think about the possibility of errors, not just, you know, that could happen, not just while qubits are sitting around, but also when gates are being done, and including the phase of the procedure where you're doing syndrome measurement and when you're doing corrections. I mean, there will be many kinds of operations in such a protocol, and you have to take, you know, all the places where errors could occur into account. But it's possible to do that so that if you have a physical error rate that, you know, you think of as an error occurring with probability p, then you get some logical error rate which is higher order. It's possible to do this. And then the next thing that you do, so what we would like to do is we would like to make the error rate arbitrarily small. And there's a nice strategy for doing that, which involves what's called concatenated coding. So then what we do is we concatenate the code. Concatenate the construction with itself. So, yes. So, you know, what we do is we design some protocol for doing any of the gates that we might want to implement. And it's supposed to have the property that if, you know, during the execution of that, there's an error probability p for each operation, then, you know, the probability of an error for the overall implementation is actually order p squared if you only look at errors on the logical qubits. Does that make sense? That's right. I mean, you have to say exactly what the error model is, but that's probably a good way to think about it. That every time, you know, some gate is done in this implementation, it causes, an error with probability p. I mean, we could think about it maybe as a depolarizing channel, say, where like, you know, at each step, you know, where each step corresponds to doing some gate, or possibly just having a qubit sit around, you know, there's a probability 1 minus p that the qubit is left untouched, and a probability p that it's replaced with a maximally mixed state. Yeah, probably. And probably an identity gate would. I mean, this is up to you when you design the error model, but the reasonable kind of thing to do is to say that even when a qubit is sitting around, you know, there's some probability p of an error, you know, at every time step. Yes?
I gather in these models we're assuming it's impossible to lose a qubit entirely, like to have a qubit tunnel out of your system and run away to Andromeda?
Well, again, this comes down to your error model, right? So there is a kind of error that people consider, which is called an erasure error, which is exactly what you're describing. Like basically the qubit is just lost. And you know, you could try to correct against errors like this as well. I mean, you know, the kinds of codes that we've looked at can correct against these erasure errors because you're storing the information redundantly. Yeah. I mean, what we would like is that the effective error rate on the logical qubits when the gate is finished is order p squared. So in other words, if you think about the probability that an error is introduced not by the physical gates but by the encoded gates, that's order p squared. All right, so then once we have this, what we want to do is concatenate this construction. And the idea is that if you've got some procedure that turns an error probability p into an error probability p squared, well, now if you do this again, you're going to make the error rate even smaller. You're going to square it again. Now there's some issues. There are many issues here that I'm really sweeping under the rug. Like, for example, you have to think about what happens to the error model. What does the error model look like on the logical qubits? It doesn't necessarily look exactly the same as the raw error model did on the physical qubits, and you have to be careful about these kinds of issues. But you can be careful about these kinds of issues and get it that when you do this, effectively, what happens is you square the error. Okay, so if we do this, we can concatenate the construction with itself, and that's going to give us a much better error probability. But on the other hand, it's also going to blow up the size of the computation and the number of gates that we have to do. Right, so if we concatenate the 7-qubit code with itself, right, then we have we originally have a qubit stored into 7 qubits, and then if we concatenate this code with itself, in other words, encode every one of those 7 qubits using the 7-qubit code, now we have 49 qubits, right? So as we concatenate this, actually the number of qubits that we will be using goes up exponentially. Right, so this sounds like maybe it's a little bit troublesome. So the number of qubits will go up exponentially with the number of levels of concatenation. But on the other hand, the error probability goes down even faster than that, right? The error probability is getting squared every time. So that's going to go down doubly exponentially. So the error rate, the probability of an error, goes down doubly exponentially. So what that says is you really don't have to concatenate very many times before the error probability is incredibly tiny. And so the fact that the number of qubits is going up exponentially is actually not as bad as it might first seem. Okay, so if you kind of carefully analyze these kinds of fault-tolerant constructions and the effects of concatenation, and you do a lot of careful counting of how errors could affect, how errors could propagate and these sorts of things, then what you can ultimately prove is something which is, a very important theorem about the plausibility of actually building a quantum computer, which is what's called the fault-tolerant threshold theorem. And what this says is that we only need to have our raw physical error rate to be below some fixed threshold that doesn't depend on the size of the computation we might want to do. So if the probability of error, so this is like the probability of error per time step, right? So every time we do some operation, it's the probability that an error occurs. So if this error rate is below some fixed threshold, and what that threshold is going to depend on details of the error model and exactly what code you take. But maybe a reasonable kind of ballpark kind of figure to have in the back of your head is maybe like 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4, something like that. So then we can compute for an arbitrarily long time with effectively no error. Well, I'm not being very precise here. The theorem would have things like epsilons in it. But this is kind of the spirit of it. And so, you know, what you could say in particular is that the overhead, so, you know, the number of additional qubits that you need in order to do this, right, so the overhead is only going to be actually logarithmic. So it's not even that going to be the case that you need, say, quadratically more qubits or something like that, you know, polynomially many qubits. You actually only need a logarithmic overhead. So the overhead is only logarithmic. So when I say it's logarithmic in, you know, in the, well, 1 over the error that you're trying to achieve, and in the, you know, in the length of the computation that you're trying to do. Right? So you will definitely need more qubits than you would need if you could, you know, if you truly had no error, but only logarithmically more. So that's really not so bad. So, you know, what this basically says, what this basically justifies is that, you know, it seems like we really ought to be able to build a quantum computer in practice. You know, we only have to get some constant amount of control. We don't have to get better and better control as we want to do larger and larger computations. If we can get below whatever this threshold is, then we're good to go, right? If we can make our errors small enough, we can in principle scale things up to arbitrarily large computations. Now, of course, many assumptions go into proving a threshold theorem like this. Like, for example, in the first threshold theorems that were proved, there was this assumption of IID errors, where the errors really occurred independently on all of the qubits. And certainly making an assumption like that makes it easier to prove a threshold theorem. But theorems like this have been proven for a variety of error models. And so, for example, you can even handle the case where you have certain kinds of correlated errors. And you know, there's a lot of work that goes into trying to prove threshold theorems with more and more relaxed assumptions. So if you have more questions about this, well, I mean, I'd certainly be glad to talk with you about it, you know, after the lecture. But Daniel Gottesman, who's here at PI, is really, you know, a world expert in this subject and would also be a great person to talk to. Okay. So questions about this now? This is all I'm going to say about fault tolerance. I guess I probably spent more time than I meant to anyway, but yes. Well, it's exponential in the number of levels, but the question is, what level do you have to go to, right? How many times do you actually have to concatenate? And because the error rate goes down so fast, you really don't have to concatenate the code many times. So if you had to concatenate the code, you know, a number of times that was like, you know, linear in the length of the computation you wanted to do, that would be terrible. That would give you exponential overhead. But that's not what you need. It only needs to be like log log, because the error is going down doubly exponentially. So this is why, I mean, basically why you have only logarithmic overhead. Good. Other questions? Okay, so the last thing we're going to talk about is quantum key distribution. Okay, so now we're getting back to cryptography. I mean, we talked a little bit about cryptography before as the motivation for you know, being interested in solving the factoring problem, because the RSA cryptosystem is based on the idea that factoring is hard. But so, you know, the question here is, like, how can we communicate securely? How can two parties communicate securely? And, you know, the way that this is usually done in practice nowadays is to use cryptosystems that are based on computational assumptions, like the assumption that factoring is hard. But, you know, we saw that that's not a good assumption if you can build a quantum computer. So we don't want to base cryptography on, well, on assumptions that don't hold, right? So if we could actually build large-scale quantum computers, then the RSA assumption would really be a bad assumption. Of course, you know, maybe you could come up with, you know, public key cryptosystems like RSA, but that are based on different assumptions that still hold, even if we can build quantum computers, and that's something that people think about. But certainly you should be a little bit worried about making those kinds of assumptions. You know, things like Shor's algorithm should make you concerned, because it could be that, you know, someone figures out a good idea to build a quantum algorithm, you know, tomorrow, and that'll break RSA, and maybe it'll break other kinds of cryptosystems. You know, you should also just be worried about the possibility that someone comes up with a fast algorithm for factoring tomorrow, and, you know, a fast classical algorithm for factoring, right? And, you know, maybe that happens, and then we switch over to some other cryptosystem based on, you know, the hardness of solving lattice problems, which is another leading candidate. But maybe someone has a clever idea and comes up with a fast algorithm for those problems, right? So, if your cryptography is based on computational assumptions that you can't prove, then you're on kind of shaky ground. So it would be really nice to have cryptography that doesn't rely on any on any you know, computational assumptions. And actually, it's possible to do that, and it's been known how to do that for a long time, like well before people thought about quantum information. So it's possible to have to send perfectly secure messages using what's called private key cryptography. So we can communicate with what's called information theoretic security. Which means there are no computational assumptions. I mean, there are no assumptions at all about the security. Using what's called private key cryptography. And another name for this is what's called the one-time pad. And the idea for this is very simple, but you'll see that there's a problem with it. That's what quantum quantum information is going to help us get around. Okay, but let's just see what the basic scheme is. So the idea is that we have two parties, Alice and Bob. They would like to communicate securely. So say Alice would like to send a message to Bob, but they're far apart from each other and they have some channel which someone might be eavesdropping on, right? So there's some potential eavesdropper Eve who could be listening in. And so if they just send messages in the clear, that's certainly no good. So how this private key cryptosystem would work is the following. So to send a bit, m sub I, so this is some, well, let me just write m. So, Alice wants to send a bit m. What Alice and Bob are going to do is they're going to use up a bit of shared key. So this key is going to be a resource that they're going to have available to them. But let's imagine that they have it. So let's imagine that Alice and Bob have some string of random bits. So these bits are truly uniformly random, and they're the only ones who know them. So the eavesdropper doesn't know anything about these random bits. So suppose that Alice and Bob share a secret uniformly random bit k, so this is a bit of key. Well, then there's a way that they can send the message in such a way that the Eve can just not get any information whatsoever about the message bit m. So what they do is the following. So Alice just computes the XOR of m and k. So she adds m to k mod 2. And now this is going to be a bit of the ciphertext, so we'll call this C. And Eve can get absolutely no information about M from C, because basically from Eve's perspective, this bit M was just randomized, right? With probability half, it was left the same. With probability half, it was flipped. So there's just no information in C about M if you don't know what K is, right? So Eve can get no information about M from C, well, assuming that she doesn't know K, okay? But this is, I said there were no assumptions, but I guess there's this assumption, that Alice and Bob have this shared key, but certainly this is an assumption that you could make plausible, if, say, Alice and Bob met, and they, they flipped a bunch of coins, they agreed on some shared random string, and then they went far apart from each other, and later wanted to exchange secret messages. Okay, so the idea is that they do have this resource, which is this shared random bit. So Eve can get no information about M from C, but on the other hand, Bob can easily reconstruct what the message is. So Bob can compute, he just takes the ciphertext and adds back in the key bit, and of course that's going to be the message bit, right? Because if you add the key bit twice, then you just get back to the original thing. If you flip the bit twice, or don't flip the bit twice, then you just get back to the message bit, right? So Bob can reconstruct the message, and Alice, can be sure that Eve didn't learn anything about the message. Now, of course, Eve can always do things like, block the transmission. I mean, there's no way to prevent some kind of an attack like that. But if if the message, well, and she could also screw up the transmission, right? She could mess up the bit so that Bob would get some kind of garbage out. But given that the message gets through untouched, then certainly, given that the ciphertext gets through untouched, then certainly Bob will be able to recover it. And under no circumstances could Eve have learned anything about it. Okay. So this is the sense in which there's information theoretic security from this this notion of private key cryptography. Okay, but it has a big disadvantage, right? Which is the reason that we don't actually use this in practice. So like when you buy something, from Amazon on the internet or something like that, you're not actually using private key cryptography, you're using RSA. And the reason for that is that for this to be secure, you have to actually exchange the key somehow, right? So you can do that maybe by meeting. Alice and Bob meet in some secure location, they flip some coins, they write down their shared key, they put their key in a briefcase and handcuff it to their arm, and then they go back to their places where they where they can store it securely, and then they can exchange secret messages. But if they're not able to meet, then there's just no way to distribute a secret key. I mean, you can't just like send the key over the insecure channel, because Eve would know what it was. She would get information about it. So this is a problem. Key distribution requires Alice and Bob to meet. So they have to actually be in the same physical location. Yes?
Why are you going to RSA?
Well, it relies on computational assumptions. So maybe, someone thinks of a factoring algorithm, a fast classical factoring algorithm, and then you can't, then it's just not secure. Yeah. Okay. So this is nice, and I guess if you really want to, if you really want to be absolutely sure that your communications are secure, then you could use this. But there's a high price to pay, which is that distributing the keys is really hard. Okay, so quantum key distribution lets us get around this. So the idea of quantum key distribution is that there's actually a way to distribute a secret key so that we can be sure that Eve has no information about it, despite the fact that Alice and Bob have never met. And this is somehow just like clearly impossible in the classical world, because the only thing you could do is send classical information, and any classical information you send could be eavesdropped on, so there's just no way you could be sure that that you got a shared key about which Eve had no information. But quantum mechanics lets us do this. So QKD lets us distribute a key without meeting. Okay. Right. Okay. Oh yeah. So I guess there's one other thing that I should mention. So so the idea here is that Alice and Bob are going to be able to exchange quantum messages, which are, so they're going to be sending quantum messages through an insecure channel where there could potentially be an eavesdropper listening in. So we have this kind of a situation where now Alice can send quantum particles to Bob, say. But there is one other thing which is going to be required, which is that it's going to be important that that Alice and Bob somehow know that they're talking to each other in order to do the key distribution. So we're going to also assume that they have what's called an authenticated quantum channel. So this is just like a kind of a little caveat. So they also need an authenticated classical channel. So that doesn't mean that it's private. Of course, if they had some kind of a private channel, then they could just distribute key through it. So someone could listen in on this channel. But what's meant by authenticated is that when Bob receives a message, he knows that it was really sent by Alice. And basically, the reason that you need this is that otherwise, an eavesdropper could mount some kind of a man-in-the-middle attack, where she would just pretend to be Bob, and you would think you were creating key with Bob, but you're actually creating key with the eavesdropper, right? So this would be a problem. So you have to know that the person you're talking to is really the person that you think you're talking to. And you can do this kind of thing using not very much not very much at all in the way of randomness. So maybe you need some initial randomness in order to satisfy this assumption of being able to send authenticated messages. But once you have this, then you can use QKD to expand that key. So you really only need some small amount of initial seed randomness, which maybe you could create by Alice and Bob actually meeting, and then you can once you go far apart, you can do authentication and you can distribute as much key as you like and expand that key to be arbitrarily big. Yes.
I thought earlier that you said
that they need an authenticated quantum channel. I may have misspoken. They just need an authenticated classical channel. So they need to have some classical channel that where they know where the messages are coming from, but the quantum messages may have been messages that were received by Eve and then sent on. Okay. So now what's the idea? How could we try to so now we're going to assume that when there is some classical discussion that it actually is Alice and Bob who are communicating. So let's think about what quantum data they could send back and forth in order to establish some kind of a secret key. So there's a protocol for doing this, which is called the BB84 protocol. And here's sort of a basic unit of that protocol. And we'll add some steps at the end later on, but here's going to be the basic idea. So first, what Alice is going to do is she's going to create some quantum states that she's going to send over to Bob. Well, let's just think about what she does one qubit at a time. So first of all, Alice chooses a state at random, and it's going to be either a zero state, a one state, or a plus state, or a minus state. So zero, one, plus, minus, so each with probability a quarter. Let me just write at random, but I mean uniformly at random. Okay. Maybe you start to see why it's the case that this is the kind of thing that we could hope to do with present day technology. I mean, the only kinds of things they're going to have to do are prepare states like this, send them around, and make measurements on these states in a simple set of bases. So the resources that we need for this protocol will be far less than what we would need to do a large scale quantum computation. So Alice is going to just choose one of these, four simple states, and then she sends it to Bob. You just write A for Alice and B for Bob. So she sends it over to Bob, and now what's he going to do? Well, he's going to measure it. So what he would like to do is he would like to measure it in a good basis in order to get some information out. But of course, he has no way of knowing what basis Alice prepared her state in. She randomly chose either the computational basis or the Hadamard basis. And then within that basis, she randomly chose one of the two states. Bob doesn't know which basis she picked, so he's just going to choose at random. Bob measures in either 0, 1, or plus minus basis, each with probability at half. Again, let me just write it at random, but I mean uniformly at random. Okay, so now, of course, there are two things that could happen, right? Bob could have picked the basis, a basis that's commensurate with the basis that Alice used for the preparation, and if that's the case, he's going to get a signal that's perfectly correlated with Alice's signal, right? So if she prepared a state in the computational basis and he measured in the computational basis, then he definitely gets the outcome corresponding to what Alice prepared. But of course, if he picks the wrong basis, then he just gets garbage. Okay. But now what he can do, what they can do afterwards, so after Bob has performed these measurements, is they can have a public discussion, which will take place over this authenticated classical channel, about what bases they measured in. So they won't share the information about whether they, about which measurement outcomes they got or which states were prepared, but just about the bases that they measured in. So Alice and Bob publicly, I mean, I say publicly because, any communication that they do has to be done publicly, right? That's the assumption that the eavesdropper could be listening in. So they might as well just, publish their bases in the New York Times. So publicly announce their you know, preparation and measurement bases. So preparation if it's Alice and measurement if it's Bob. But not their, you know, not which state in the bases they prepared and not which outcomes they got. And now they might as well just discard the states in which they in which Bob measured in the wrong basis. So, and discard outcomes where the bases don't agree. Okay, and now for the remaining states, for the states where the bases did agree, well, if there was no if there was no noise in the channel and if there was no eavesdropping that took place, then the signals that the signals that Bob received would be exactly the same as the signals that Alice sent. And they're also, you know, they're also uniformly random because Alice was randomly choosing either 0, 1 or plus minus. So then they would have some bits that definitely agree with each other and that are that are uniformly random. In other words, you know, they maybe could think about this as what something they would like to use as the key K. Okay, so the so with no noise or eavesdropping, the remaining bits agree and are uniformly random. Okay. So, of course, this is what would happen if there was no eavesdropping taking place, but we have to worry about the possibility that there was some eavesdropping that was taking place. But now the thing to observe is that if Eve is listening in on the channel, if she's trying to do some eavesdropping, there is no way for her to do that without having some possibility of detection. So this is really sort of like the main idea. So Eve can't get information without having some possibility of being detected. And maybe a better way of saying this is that she can't get any information without disturbing the state. So you can formalize this in terms of what's called an information disturbance trade-off, where when you have some quantum state in an unknown basis, if you want to get information about it, you necessarily have to disturb it, and you can quantify this effect. So maybe to start to get a little bit of a handle on this, it's perhaps worthwhile to think about a kind of attack that Eve might do, which is called intercept resend. So this is the intercept resend attack. So something that Eve could do is she could say, well, I don't know what basis Alice prepared the state in. So I'm just going to guess. I'm just going to do kind of the thing that Bob would do. I'm just going to randomly choose to either measure in the computational or the Hadamard transform basis. And then I'll just send on the state that I got. So if Eve gets lucky and she happens to choose the same basis that Alice prepared the state in, then of course she learns what the state was, and she doesn't disturb it at all because she just gets an outcome that was consistent with the state that Alice actually prepared. She sends it on, and then Bob, if Bob happened to measure that qubit in the right basis, which happened with probability half, it's very distracting. Okay, so with probability half, Bob would actually keep that qubit, and then. So then Eve would have one bit of key, right? So there's some chance. So what we're saying here is that Eve measures in a random basis, random 0, 1, or plus minus basis. And then there's going to be some probability that she'll actually learn a bit of key, assuming that Alice and Bob actually keep all of the candidate qubits, which is not what they're going to do in the end. But if they were going to do that, then with some probability, she learns a bit of key, which is bad for Alice and Bob. But on the other hand, you know, there's a probability half that she measures in the wrong basis, and then she disturbs the state a lot, right? So then it could be that Alice prepared a plus state. Eve guesses that she should measure in the 0-1 basis. Well, then she gets some random bit that just has no information about anything, and she projects the state onto either the 0 or 1 state. But now, if that's going to be a bit that, you know, that Alice and Bob are eventually going to keep for key, because they only keep bits for which they agree on the measurement bases, it must be that, you know, that Bob was also measuring in the plus minus basis. And since, you know, since Eve measured in the 0-1 basis, she prepared something that was either a state 0 or 1, so there's a probability half that Bob will get an outcome that doesn't agree with the state that Alice prepared, right? So she's disturbed the state, Eve has disturbed the state by actually quite a bit. So with some also fairly large probability, she's going to get Alice and Bob into a situation where they have these candidate key bits that disagree. So Alice and Bob will get bits that should agree but don't. So that means that this eavesdropping can be detected, right? This kind of intercept or send attack can be detected. So the way they can detect it would be, you know, Alice and Bob could choose some subset of these candidate key bits and check whether they actually agree, right? They could send them over their authenticated classical channel, say, you know, hey, I got a 0, did you get a 0? And if Alice prepared a 0 and Bob got a 1, then they know that something is going on, right? They know that, well, someone could be listening in, or it could just be that the channel is noisy, right? And any realistic channel, of course, has, you know, some noise in it. So, they don't necessarily want to just abort the protocol every time they get any outcome that disagrees. That would be, overly paranoid and not really necessary. But what they can do is they can post-process the information that comes out of this protocol in order to, handle the case where there could possibly be some eavesdropping going on, or there could just be noise in the channel, but they'll attribute any noise in the channel to eavesdropping. But such that the final information that comes out of the protocol at the end will be something, you know, will give them some key about which they can be sure that Eve has no information. So what they're going to do to ensure this will be to improve the protocol. So here's the full BB84 protocol. So the first thing that they're going to do is they're going to, you know, repeat the basic unit of the protocol n times. They're going to repeat the basic protocol n times. And this is going to give them some candidate key bits. And, you know, for large n, they'll get about n over 2 candidate key bits, right? Because there's a probability half that Alice and Bob measured Alice prepared a state in a basis that was the basis that Bob measured in. That happens with probability half. So, you know, if there's no noise in the channel, they would get about n over 2 candidate key bits. They get about n over 2 candidate key bits regardless of whether there's noise in the channel, right? Because this just has to do with what bases what bases Alice chose and what bases Bob measured in. And so this happens regardless of whether there's any noise in the channel, that they're about n over 2 candidate key bits. And now what they're going to do is they're going to choose some subset of the bits that they're going to use to do some kind of a check. So let's say that Bob does that. So Bob chooses a subset of, you know, let's say half of the candidate key bits. They're going to use half of them for checking for eavesdropping, and they'll keep the other half to hopefully make some key. So Bob chooses a subset of about n over 4 of the remaining bits. And what he's going to do is he's going to announce their values and which bits they were, their locations in the string and their values. So he sends these over the public but authenticated classical channel. Okay, and now what Alice and Bob would like to do is use this information in order to estimate some kind of an error rate. Oh, I guess I said that. It doesn't matter. Okay, who does this actually? But I guess what I wrote in my notes was that Alice does this. Basically what they do is, one of them has to choose some subset of the bits that they're going to look at, and then they're going to discuss, whether they had the same values for those bits. Okay, so then what Bob is going to do, if Bob knows what those locations and values were, now these bits are going to be, discarded. They're never going to be used for key. They're only being used for checking for eavesdropping. So it's okay that the values were sent in the clear. And what Bob can do is he's going to estimate an error rate for the channel. So Bob estimates a bit error rate based on the empirical rate of errors that he sees, right? So he has some, measurement results that he got. These were all bits where he was measuring in the right basis because all the other stuff was discarded anyway. And so he can estimate an empirical bit error rate that's like, the fraction of the time that, the bit that he measured disagreed with the bit that Alice prepared among these n over 4 bits that Alice suggested that they should use to do this estimation that were chosen at random. Okay, so Bob is going to estimate a bit error rate, and if that error rate is too high, then he's going to abort. Because if the error rate is too high, it could be that all the errors were due to eavesdropping, and if the error rate is, above some threshold, it's just not going to be possible for them to establish a key that they can be sure is secure. So if this is above some threshold, which, now you have to do some analysis to see kind of what threshold you should use, but I think you can handle a threshold of something about 20%. So if more than like 20% of the signals were errors in this among these n over 4 bits that were compared, then what they're going to do is abort. So on the other hand, if they don't abort, now they sort of have some confidence. They've got some estimate that suggests that there can't have been too much eavesdropping. Okay, but now what they have to do is, there could have been some eavesdropping, so they have to process the data a bit more in order to make sure that, there could have been some noise and there could have been some eavesdropping. So they have to make sure that, first of all, the bits that they had all agree, right? So if there were errors in the channel or if there was some eavesdropping, this could have led to, the bits that Bob received differing from the bits that Alice sent. So that's the first thing that they have to do. So this is called information reconciliation. So what they're going to do is, compute some, and again, this will be done using some discussion over the public channel. So Alice and Bob compute parities of subsets of their inputs. And they'll use this information to ensure that their bits actually agree. So this is called information reconciliation. And it uses ideas from error-correcting codes. So these parity checks will be, some information that has to do with some classical error-correcting codes, and they'll use this to fix things up so that they are sure that their keys are the same. Yes?
Two questions. One is, when you say compute parities of subsets of their inputs, so Alice has a string of bits, and she
No, the subsets will involve many bits. So,
sorry, to compute parity.
Well, they'll compute the parity of some, so they'll look at some, they'll take some subset of their bits and they'll check whether there's an even or an odd number of ones in that subset. Not necessarily just two bits, but just many of them.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, how they use that information to sort of, correct things. I mean, this has to do with classical error correcting codes and We're already over by a minute, so I'm not going to say anything about how this works. But yeah, so they're going to do something that has to do with classical error correcting codes in order to ensure that that their keys actually agree. So they use these to correct some bit flip errors. And then the last thing that they do is something called privacy amplification. So here they basically use some kind of hashing. So now what they're going to do is they're going to compute parities, again, some parities of subsets of their bits, and actually use this to produce the actual key. So Alice and Bob compute parities of the remaining bits. I guess I should have said that when they're doing this information reconciliation, they'll also be discarding some bits. So every time they compute some parity, there's going to be some associated bit that they're going to discard in order to ensure that they don't reveal more information to an eavesdropper. So they're going to compute parities of the remaining bits to produce the key. So this is the real honest to goodness key that they're going to use. So this is something that's called privacy amplification. And you should sort of think of this step as like error correcting codes, and this step as some kind of hashing, if that helps. Okay, so that's the overall protocol, and what we would like to think is that this sort of once we put all of these steps together, that things are actually secure, that it's just not possible for an eavesdropper to learn any substantial information about even one bit of the key that Alice and Bob share at the end of the day. So she has a very small probability of being able to guess even one bit of the key. And it turns out that you can actually prove this. So this can be proven secure. With some, of course, you have to make some assumptions about the model of what's going on. So like, for example, things about accuracy of the detectors and the sources that Alice and Bob are using, but with reasonable assumptions on the sources and detectors, well, of course, you have to look at the assumptions and decide whether you think they're reasonable. But so maybe I'll put that in quotes. But with reasonable assumptions about, for example, the sources and the detectors. So the first kind of proof that did this in a simple model where I think the sources and detectors were perfect, but otherwise it could be proven secure, and then these assumptions were later relaxed. But this original proof was given by Shor, so there's that name again, and Preskill in 2000. Whereas this protocol was actually proposed in 1984. By Bennett and Broussard. So it was a long time between when the protocol was proposed and when there was actually a true security proof. But so now we have actually proofs that say that protocols like this are secure. Okay. So another thing that I wanted to just quickly mention is that there's a kind of an interesting relationship between protocols like this and protocols that are based on entanglement. So there's another kind of strategy that you could imagine that they could use, which would be that if Alice and Bob would share a maximally entangled state, then they could measure that state in the computational basis, and they would get correlated bits. And there's a principle which sometimes goes by the name of monogamy of entanglement that says that if you truly have a maximally entangled state, then that state can't be entangled with anything else. And so that principle gives you some assurance that if you have if you truly had an entangled state, and you produced a key in that way, that it would really be secure. And you can verify that you really have a maximally entangled state, say, by violating a Bell inequality maximally. So there's another kind of approach to quantum key distribution protocols, which is based on entanglement. And you'll see a connection between these entanglement-based protocols and the these what are called prepare and measure schemes, like BB84, on the last assignment. Okay, and the last thing I just wanted to mention has to do with a concept that's been of a lot of interest recently, which is what's called device-independent cryptography. So whenever you realize some kind of a scheme like this, you could worry that maybe there could be some sort of side channel attacks that you might not think about. So for example, you know, when these sorts of schemes are realized in practice, maybe these signals are sent using photons, and there could be some additional degree of freedom of the photons that you don't think about that someone could go in and measure and use to get some information about the key. And it's very hard to rule these things out in some kind of a, you know, model of you know, how the protocol works that you can use to prove a theorem like this. These side channel attacks, you know, sort of would go around the model and allow you to, you know, possibly break the system, you know, by attacking the implementation instead of attacking the you know, the theorem, which of course is true. So you can't attack the theorem. So this is sort of a problem, but there's this idea of device-independent cryptography, where maybe if you could really base the security of QKD on assumptions like the violation of Bell inequalities, then, you know, maybe you could build you could build a quantum key distribution protocol that would work even under the assumption that an adversary supplied you with the device. So even if, you know, Eve was the person who built the sources and the detectors that you're using in order to distribute your key, you can still be confident that actually the protocol is right because you're violating some Bell inequality, and that's something you could only do if you actually had these maximally entangled states. So this is something that people have thought about for a long time. I mean, already in the early 90s, people were thinking about the possibility of this. And only recently, like only in the past year, people have actually shown, you know, have actually proven theorems that say that things like this should be possible. And so this is, you know, well, so there aren't implementations of schemes like that that are practical yet, but it's you know, certainly interesting theoretically, and maybe it's a promising avenue for future devices. Okay, so I think that's all we have time for, except maybe I can take one last question or two, if there are some. Yes. I said that they could use side channel attacks. So you know, the idea would be maybe that the, you know, maybe they encode these zero and one states in maybe horizontal and vertical polarizations of a photon. But maybe when you polarize your photons in the horizontal vertical direction or the you know, 45 degree, you know, the other possible directions that would correspond to the plus minus states, maybe you send out your photons a little bit sooner, say, than when you prepare the zero one states because you use some different apparatus to prepare them, something like that. That's the kind of side channel that you could use to maybe attack the implementation. But I'm not sure. So you said something about quantum side information, but
yeah, just in the word side around the context, and I wasn't sure what it was referring to.
So yeah, I'm not sure if the context you've seen it in is the same as what I'm talking about now. But these side channel attacks would be based on, you know, looking for other degrees of freedom that you might not think about in the implementation of the protocol. Okay, so I guess we're really out of time. So thanks, it's been fun.